Welcome to Moolala, Money Made Simple on SiriusXM. Here's your host, Bruce Sellery.
Hello, I'm Bruce Sellery. This is Moolala, Money Made Simple. Life as a professional athlete isn't exactly like what you see on TV. Sure, players might be pulling in millions of dollars a year, but they still need to go out and buy groceries every once in a while, and they still need a financial plan. We're going to talk to an advisor from the Players Office, a wealth management firm focused on advising professional athletes. Then by the time payday rolls around, your last check may be long gone, well before you find a few pennies to put into savings. What if there was a way to save without limiting your spending? We'll talk more about a new automated investment app that helps you achieve your financial goals by investing your loose change and taxing unhealthy behavior. A new study from Consumer Reports found that 42% of Americans, admittedly they're Americans, but they favor a government tax on unhealthy food. Wow. We don't have the Canadian numbers on this one, but we're going to use that as a way to talk about the price elasticity of Snickers bars. Plus, in need of some extra cash? If your day job just isn't cutting it anymore, you might consider finding extra side work to boost your finances. There's one option called Instacart. It's a new grocery shopping service that pays you to grocery shop for others. That's ahead. Let's get started. There's this TV show on HBO called Ballers. It tells the story of a former football player turned money manager for professional athletes. Yeah, it's actually a thing. But in real life, the glamour might be a little more muted than the TV show. I don't know. Brandon Hill is a certified financial planner with the Players Office, a Toronto-based wealth management firm focused on professional athletes. Hello there.
How's it going, Bruce?
Okay, so give me one example of high glam and one example of low glam. Like, you're like, ooh, yeah, I work with professional athletes. It's so cool. And then one example of, but I still have to figure out the paperwork.
I guess so. High glam, one of the cool aspects is meeting a client at a game. So that's pretty fun, you know, a Saturday night, 7 o'clock, going heading down to the ACC.
Yeah.
So that's definitely a higher glam part of it. The lower glam part of it is... Sometimes chasing them down, trying to get them organized.
Sign the check, for God's sakes!
Exactly. Or there's lots of paperwork, heavy regulated industry.
Right.
That's still kind of, it's getting better in terms of innovation. I'm also trying to help with that. But at the same time, pretty regulated, so lots of paperwork, compliance, and audit-based.
It's a pretty attractive niche in terms of glam, anyway. And we'll talk about how it is in real life. But how did you get into it? How did you make this segue? You worked for a more traditional firm first.
I did, yes. Yeah. So went to Laurier University. And while I was there, I was doing courses towards the CFP on the side.
Yep.
Very interested in personal finance, investing, the kind of whole holistic financial planning, as well as grew up playing hockey and tons of sports. So kind of married those two passions into one, getting into financial planning, and then two, working with athletes. And then specifically how I got in, I actually grew up with a guy who ended up making it to the NHL. And so then started working with him when in his early years. And then from there, probably been working with him for the last 4.5 years. And so built up that level of expertise. So it was actually more recently that I specifically decided to focus on the athlete niche.
What are some of the issues that these athletes deal with that the rest of us do not deal with? What's different for them?
Right. So one of the main things is the earning curve, or kind of that time frame of when they make their income. So the kind of traditional route is you graduate school, maybe start making your entry level contract or salary base. And then as you approach your 40s, 50s and 60s are your peak earning years, where these athletes are kind of either coming out of school or right out of high school and earning potentially millions of dollars. So that's one major.
And potentially for a very short period of time.
Exactly. Yeah. So the average, I know it probably changes every year, but the last time I saw it, the average NHL career is only 2.4 years.
Whoa, really?
Yes. So actually, sorry, 2.4 million average income over 5.5 years. But that's really stretched out from the Sidney Crosbys, those guys, the Jaromir Jagrs that are playing until they're 45. It's a lot more common for a young player to maybe play his entry-level contract and then maybe only get one more contract after that.
Sports Illustrated did a piece a bunch of years ago that said that 80% of NFL athletes go broke within 3 years after their playing career ends. Whatever that number actually is, it's probably higher than the population in general. Why do you think it? Why is that?
So I think two major areas. One, potentially poor investment decisions. So chasing returns, looking after that sexy investment. So maybe opening up your own restaurant or investing right away in a hot new startup. That could potentially go sour. And as well as lifestyle creep. During your playing years, you have this really high income coming in where you're able to afford these luxury vehicles, extensive trips, high-end mansions. But once your playing years are done, the bills don't go away. The assets still need to be paid for, but your income is now potentially zero.
How do you have that conversation with a client? Because I can imagine to do your job well, you kind of have to play the bad guy and say, listen, we got to be saving 80% of that salary now so that you're going to have money in your 80s.
Exactly, yeah. So it's a balance. A lot of it's coming from the education behind it. So how much you could put away today, how much does that look like over a lifetime at a conservative rate of return? It's all about the education and then finding that balance with the individual of still kind of living that luxurious lifestyle while setting yourself up for the future. So it's kind of that give and take a little bit in terms of, yes, maybe you can treat yourself to a higher end SUV once you've started saving and developed that core portfolio. But at the same time, you're going to have that balance of, yes, you can spend on luxurious items, but also make sure you're putting money away to take care of, so you can live comfortably for the rest of your life.
How do you work with the other service providers that most of these athletes probably have? Like they're going to have, I don't know, a manager, there's having someone negotiate their contract, there's going to be an accountant to deal with tax. Like there's a lot of things that they would have in terms of services. Where does the financial advisor fit within that mosaic?
Exactly. So I would think that the agent is really that initial trusted relationship. They start working with the players kind of when they're 13, 14, 15 years old. Before the financial planner comes in, or I see myself as, I then kind of help everywhere in the wealth management aspect. So I like to provide a one-stop shop, one kind of trusted coordinated relationship that I'll then bring in the cross-border tax accountants, potentially insurance specialists or cross-border portfolio management companies. So I kind of really want to be that financial quarterback and working in collaboration with the agent.
What have you noticed about the typical athlete's engagement with the sort of investment decisions that you're putting in front of them? I mean, a lot of clients in the regular world are completely disinterested in anything. They don't care. Just make it work. Just make it all okay. Do you find that some of your clients are more engaged in those kinds of decisions and want to have conversation about, you know, interest rates and durable goods orders and all that kind of stuff?
So I get what you're saying. So a little bit, they definitely do like to be engaged and understand the why. That's my key goal, is understand the why. Why are you investing? Why are you investing like this? But the actual nitty gritty details, I find a lot of the times they're not interested in that, but they are interested in kind of what's that holistic picture and what makes this investment a smart decision within the big financial plan.
How do you build your practice? What's different about business development when your client is such a specific sector and such a specific, I don't know, personality type?
And so what I've found is that within professional sports, as well as the hockey industry specifically, it's a really relationship-based business. So business development comes through kind of spending the time to nurture those relationships, meeting other people, specifically agents who have those trusted relationships with the players, and being able to develop that relationship that in the future, if they do need somebody to help them implement a financial solution, I'm there and ready for them.
What is different for you because they often move? Like you spend their whole career with a particular team in a particular city. Lots of them come from other parts of the world, the US, Europe. They're here to play for a period of time, but then they move off somewhere else. How does that affect the dynamics of your relationship?
Definitely. So one, using technology is great with the kind of all the new ability to do video Skype calls, share screens and that. It really kind of removes that location necessity of being in the same area. However, the one major thing with the moving that you need to be careful of is you need to plan for today, but also plan with flexibility in mind for tomorrow. So like that, a Canadian player might have to move to the U.S. tomorrow because they got traded.
And they don't have RRSPs in the U.S. They have a whole different framework for that.
Exactly. So you need to be very flexible in the sense that you need to make sure you have the right solutions on both sides of the border and flexible enough that you can potentially change if need be.
You work with hockey. That's one of your main focuses. What, if you could, what other athletes, what other types of sports would you love to be working in?
So one area, actually, because I grew up playing lacrosse. So I played a lot of lacrosse since I was 6 years old, grew up, played through the junior ranks. That's one area I'd like to help. And they have an interesting challenge too, because most, if not all, lacrosse players usually have to hold an extra job.
Right. That's not a lucrative sport there.
They definitely don't have the income of the NHL or even going up higher to the NBA. So that's one area that I'd be interested in kind of breaking into. And how do I help them still manage their money and set themselves up for the future while not looking at those multi-million dollar contracts?
Interesting. Brandon, thanks for coming in today.
Thanks, Bruce.
Appreciate
Great time.
It. Brandon Hill is a certified financial planner with the Players Office. We were talking about serving the sports superstars.
Listening to Moolah La, Money Made Simple with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
Financial literacy doesn't have an age limit. Whether you're 5 years old or 55 years old, whether you're questioning how to best spend your allowance or manage your retirement savings, you can always learn more about your money. Our next guest wants to provide some of that education. Kevin Cochran is the co-founder of Enriched Academy, an online education platform that teaches Canadians of all ages, backgrounds, and statuses how to achieve financial success. He joins us now from Ottawa. Hello there.
Hey, how you doing?
There is a lot of material out there, both online and offline. What would you say makes Enriched Academy different?
You know what? I think the way we deliver the information, you know, money can be a really, really dry subject, but...
Not when I'm talking about it.
Fair enough. I'm referring when we're talking to kids, that's for sure,
yeah.
Right? You know, because one of the challenges is when you... funny enough, I like that. But we went out there and we did over 1,000 events free of charge over 10 years, trying to teach students about money. And the first 50 events we did at high schools were a disaster. I mean, kids are falling asleep, just not that... You know, just it just wasn't, you know, hitting home. But, you know, after doing 1,000 events, we realized that, you know, you just got to really figure out what triggers a kid's appetite to learn about money. And it's not about retiring. It's about, you know, teaching a student in high school how to buy their first investment property while they're in college and university, because we've interviewed a ton of students how to do that, right? What's every 17-year-old want to do? They want to move out. So if you can actually teach them how to do it, whether they do it or not is not relevant. A lot of students have through our program. But what's more important is that they actually are really interested about saving money, because, you know, they're like, wow, okay, I can buy an investment property in college, university, and rent the rooms out to my friends, and, you know, pay for my tuition 4, 5, 6, 7 years after finishing high school, university because of that. It's pretty cool.
How do your participants get exposed to your programs? So you talk about students. Is this offered through schools, or is it something their parents pay for? And if so, how much does it cost?
Okay, so originally the program that we had was a 6-week, 6-DVD series. That's what we got on the show Dragon's Den with, because our program was on the show. But since then, we've evolved to so much more. We don't really sell DVD programs anymore. We actually sell our programs directly to schools. The one thing, I'll just be honest, you know, I found that most of the schools have really dragged their feet on this, but the career colleges and trade schools here right across the country have been fantastic. They've embraced it. They've made it mandatory part of their learning. Right now, we have about 15 to 20,000 students per year going through our program every year through the career colleges, schools like MedX and so forth. Unbelievable participation through.
And
through that
when
channel.
You say going through your program, is it an online experience?
It is an online experience, yeah. So there's 9 segments to it, everything from money myths to credit cards, student loans, how to invest in the stock market, real estate, mortgages, you name it, it's in there. It's pretty amazing. It's an online video-based program.
If you had to choose one really, really key lesson for a 17-year-old, what would the number one thing be?
It's not what you make. It's what you do with what you make. It's one lesson. I don't care how old you are, that's the lesson you need to understand, because, you know, I'll be in a room full of 17-year-old kids, and two will have part-time jobs. One makes $100 a week, one makes $150 a week, right? And I'll ask them how much money they have saved, and in most cases, guess how much each of them have saved.
Bupkis? Nothing?
Nothing, right? Right. Like, well, if he's making $50 more a week, he's got more money, so why doesn't he have more money, right? And every single time they start laughing, you see a light bulb go on. Well, all the students are like, oh, my gosh. I'm like, so you have one student here making $100 a week, another making $150 in their part-time jobs. You both have no overhead, right? And they're like, yeah. I go, well, it's funny. So why don't you save more money even though you make more money? And do you think it gets any easier if you go and make $50,000 a year out of your first school, you know, from your first job out of school? And they're like, they start getting it. I go, listen, saving money is exactly like lifting weights to me, right? Okay, if you can't lift or curl 100 pounds, right, as an example, you can't go curl 150 pounds. Like, you know, you don't say, well, give me more weight and I'll figure that out. And most students think, well, I'm not saving money because I don't make enough money. And most adults think the same way. Well, I can't manage $100 a week, but give me $150 and I can do that. No, you can't. If you can't manage the responsibilities of $100 a week and save $10 out of every $100, giving you $150 ain't going to solve that problem.
Right. Now, you've got a number of different streams in which you push out your education, schools, colleges. We talked a bit about companies, families. Tell me about your work with professionals, real estate, insurance agents, financial advisors, those folks.
Yeah, you know what? It's all over. We actually just signed a deal with the CFL. It was at the Grey Cup. We had a full-page article in the Financial Post earlier this week, which is pretty cool. It's funny. Financial literacy, I think there's a perception that it's for those people that are in debt or paycheck to paycheck, and it's not. Even people with money have no idea what their money is doing. I mean, we have people coming to our live events that we hold every month right across the country, and, they have $1 million with their financial advisor, but they don't know what an MER is. You know, they have no idea what their fees are. So, you know, even people that are doing it right don't really know what their money is doing. And we're not financial advisors. That's why there's such a demand for our product right now and our information, because there's no bias here. Like, what we look at it is, we're like the Rosetta Stone of money. And, Rosetta Stone is a language program. And what we look at money is, it's a language. And if you don't know what an MER is and you have a financial advisor, well, you don't get the language. Right, and Canada has the highest MERs in the world. Right?
So, is it that financial advisors will guide their clients towards your material so that they'll be a more engaged client?
Probably not, right? You know, I'm actually, a lot of people come to our events, they wonder, are we pro or against financial advisors? I like financial advisors. I think they're great. The problem is, I think 70% of them are salespeople across this country. So, and the most people don't understand you come to our event, we give you a financial advisor interrogation kit. Right? And so you know exactly what you're going to have to ask your financial advisor so you don't get it taken advantage of.
Do you call it that? Do you call it the financial advisor interrogation kit?
Yeah, absolutely.
Nice.
Yeah, you get a full kit and it tells you exactly what questions. But the problem is most people don't know what questions to ask. They're like, oh, my brother referred me, or my sister, or my dad. When they don't know, when your MERs are, north of 1.25, it's real tough to get ahead. Right. And so we have doctors, lawyers, professional athletes coming to our events, and they're like, oh, my gosh, the guy had no idea. And it's not like we're saying, hey, leave your financial advisor and come with us. We're not sitting there saying, try and take business away and have that underlying message. We're saying, hey, listen, you know what? You may want to go out there and interview two or three other financial advisors and find the right one. And here's the kit to get to do that. Right.
How has your business changed since the profile that you got from your Dragon's Den appearance?
Dragon's Den, once you're on the show, it's such a great experience, right? But, it's up to you to keep that momentum going. For a week or two, you get a lot of press, and it's amazing. But then it's up to you to keep it going. Since being on the show, we brought on a great CEO, Todd Peterson, and, he saw a different vision for the company above and beyond DVDs, and that's why we have everything online as a curriculum. We do live events right across the country. We're obviously, signed with the CFL. We're very close signing a deal with another national sports league, which is tremendously exciting. Unions, the career colleges has been phenomenal. Also just organizations and companies right across the country. They're sitting there going, I can't give raises to my employees for the rest of their lives. Like, I got to teach them how to manage their money properly. And again, the fact that we're an online video-based program, we didn't just go out there and write a book and create this speaking tour. We wanted to go out there and build a program, not just based around Kevin Cochran or anybody in the company. That's why it's called Enrich Academy. So it's been a big evolution because we're not just dealing with kids anymore. We're dealing with adults. We're dealing with new immigrants. We're dealing with everything, right?
Not that there's anything against those people who wrote books and go on.
Oh, no,
tours,
not
right?
at all. Oh,
I just kid, yeah. So tell me, how much does it cost for an individual to do the program?
If they want to go and buy it online, it's $200. That's what the program is. And actually, we're just test piloting something right now. We're pretty excited is that with our program where parents want to buy it for their kids, it's not ready yet. We're just test piloting it. What we do is we actually pay the kids to watch it. So if you buy the program for $200, and the program front to back takes about 3 hours to watch, what we do is after they watch the program and once they go online and take the test and get 70% on the test, and they can take the test as many times as they need to, we'll write a check to the kid for $50 for watching it.
Wow.
Right? So it's
I'd offer to give my kid dinner. She's not getting $50, but I'll feed her dinner.
Well, you know what? The funny thing is, it's been a really, really good motivation, right? But the one thing, again, the reason why we think we get through to kids better than most is that we've put more kids to sleep more than anybody else, right? we've test-piloted our material over and over and over and over and over again, and we put a lot of audiences to sleep to get it as funny as it is right now. And the best part of it is when the kids watch the program, after it's all said and done, the $50 check that they get, guess what they want to do with it? They want to invest it. They're trying to figure out ways, you know, how do I open a trading account? You know, we don't believe in just putting money into a savings account. You know, go out and start trading it, you know, at an early age. Get it out there. Warren Buffett said it best. I bought my first stock at age 11. I was wasting my life up until then. Right. And so if you can get kids out there investing and getting that momentum going, but the parents don't have the tools because they don't understand. Yeah. And just to add on one last thing, the reason why I think most parents fail when it comes to teaching their kids, and I get this, and they all agree when I talk to them about this, is they'll try, you know, 4, 5, 6, 10, 15 times over, you know, while they're teens, you know, start saving money, you should save money. And the kids just don't really get it. And they're not really interested. And they just kind of, parents just quit. And I get it, because I told you the first 50 events we did at high schools were a disaster, right? And it took us 1,000 times to figure this thing out. And that's why we really get through to students when they listen to our program, or watch it, excuse me. So,
Kevin, thanks for your time. Appreciate it.
I really appreciate it. Have a great day.
Kevin Cochran is co-founder of Enriched Academy, a program that teaches financial literacy. Stay with us. Coming up next on Moolala, how to make your loose change really add up. We'll talk about a new app that rounds up every purchase you make and then invests the spare change. And later, a new survey from Consumer Reports on sin taxes. Follow me at Bruce Selry on Twitter, Bruce Selry Moolala on Facebook. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Listening to Moolala, Money Made Simple, with Bruce Selry on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
I'm Bruce Selry. This is Moolala, Money Made Simple. It's hard to think about saving money when you're always spending money. $4.25 for a latte here, $42.80 on groceries there. It all adds up, except in your savings account. Doesn't add up much there. But what if there was an easy way to save and grow your money to achieve financial goals automatically? Mylo is an app that says it does that. It rounds up every purchase you make and then invests the spare change. Mylo's CEO, Philip Brar, joins us now from Montreal, Quebec. Hello there.
Hey there.
Well, tell us more about how this works. I mean, it sounds really well grounded in a lot of the things we've been learning about behavioral economics.
Yeah, Mylo is an investment application that automatically rounds up your everyday purchase and then automatically invests the spare change. So if you were to buy a coffee for $3.25, Mylo would round up that purchase to $4, take that 75 cents, and put it into a diversified portfolio of ETFs. So effectively helping you save every time you spend.
How much does that equal over time? It sounds like if that's the only thing you do, you're going to be able to save enough for, you know, a new bicycle in 20 years.
On average, a Canadian makes about 3 purchases a day. Those 3 purchases are typically about 50 cents in roundups. We'll say about $1.50 a day in roundups, or just over $500. And then you can turn on one-time deposits. So if you wanted to get a tax refund or some extra money for Christmas, you could put in a one-time deposit and boost your account, or you can put in a weekly recurring deposit to help you get there faster.
How does it connect to one's bank account? How does the interface actually work? Because part of me thinks, oh, that sounds great. It just sounds really complicated.
No, it's actually a very simple process. The whole sign-up process takes about just 3 minutes. It's fully automated on a mobile device. You don't actually have to get on the phone or go into a branch. You can do it directly from your cell phone in about 3 minutes. And you go through and you log in to your bank using your banking credentials the same way you would with like a Mint.com. So most people are familiar with Mint and have used Mint in the past. It's a very simple process to connect your bank, go through a couple risk profile questions, and then our portfolio managers help you invest that money once you get started.
On that side of the business, are you akin to any of the other robo-advisors out there, like Wealthsimple, Advisor, Nest?
Yeah, so we definitely are aware of what they're doing in the market. I think it's what we're doing is more of on a mission of financial inclusion. So we're making it accessible and affordable for every Canadian to get started. Half of Canadian millennials have less than $1,000 saved up in their bank account. regardless of income. So they can be making $30,000 a year, $130,000 a year, but they don't know where to start and they don't feel like they have enough money to get started. So what Milo does is it lets you get started with about $1. It's your first roundups are able to be invested right away and invested the same way that one of these robo-advisors would invest $100,000 or $1 million for the same strategy.
How defensible is your proposition here, the roundup model? Isn't that something that any of the robos or any of the banks, for that matter, could just bolt on?
So our big differentiator is twofold. One, we have fractional trading of ETFs. So this allows you to buy a fraction of a share. You don't need $200, $300, $400 to invest in three or four different ETFs. You can do so by getting a fraction of a share issued to you directly through Milo. We do so by essentially pooling everyone's money together and being able to give a fractional ownership. So we're based off of volume, and the volume of users we have on our platform allows us to do so. The second is we're an agnostic platform. So some people are familiar with some of the banks offering a roundup solution. But what we've seen is the banks make you go into the branch, sign up. It's not a technology-friendly platform. And it's one that actually only works with that debit card. So most people have two or three banks working with a debit or credit card from a different bank. And Milo allows you to connect all of your banks independently of one financial institution.
What does the service invest its users' money in?
It invests very similar to other robos, low-cost ETF. We have three funds, one an equity fund, a fixed income fund, a money market fund. And with those, we create five different portfolios with five different risk profiles from conservative to aggressive. And based off of what your goal is and your risk profile, our portfolio manager will put you in one of those five portfolios and invest your money in low-cost ETF diversified portfolio.
One of the things that other services like this do is users articulate goals, which help underscore the asset allocation that those investments will be in. If it's saving for tomorrow, it's obviously going to be lower risk. It's not going to be in equities. And if it's for 30 years, it could be, you know, fully in equities for a 25-year-old. How does your company manage that question?
Absolutely. So we've taken it to the extreme, I would say. We've actually built a goal-only based platform. So Milo actually allows you to invest in the goals of what you're looking for coming up. So say you're saving for vacation, Milo will have a strategy to help you save for that vacation within 6 months. Or if you're saving for retirement in 40 years, Milo has a strategy to help you do so. And with the Milo platform, you can set multiple goals. So you can actually save for your vacation coming up soon and your retirement later on, all at the same time.
There's some other add-ons here that are, if not as common, maybe not even existing with some of your competitors. Optimizing insurance coverage, maximizing travel points. How do those offerings work?
Absolutely. So, I mean, our whole mission at Milo is to help people achieve their financial goals. First, being that goal-based platform and helping them save and invest towards the goal is the first step. And then the second step is focusing, I guess, on the larger picture. Most people will spend hours trying to save $100 on their flights for their vacation, where they don't spend any time shopping around for a mortgage or insurance renewals. So what Milo does is with the information that we build and then the profile and the relationship that we're working with, we actually can help these users make better informed decisions around which products and services they should be consuming, and then therefore saving more money off of those products that they're already using every single day.
One of the distinctions that's really caught on in the fintech world is the difference between an enabler and a challenger. And in the beginning, I think all of us thought that fintech was going to be a real challenger to the incumbents, the banks in particular. Would you say that Milo is a challenger or is it an enabler? How well do you work with the existing financial institutions?
Great question. We're definitely an enabler. We've been seeing this pattern, and it's more apparent in the U.S., where people are actually starting to bank with multiple banks, they're buying different products from multiple banks. And we call this kind of the deaggregation of banking services. With Milo, what our goal is to help you reaggregate all of those different products and services with different financial institutions or other fintechs out there and helping them consolidate that all in one platform with one mobile experience. So we definitely are an enabler, and we want to help our users make the best financial decisions and work with the best institutions that have their interests in mind.
How advanced is the technology on your platform? I mean, we talk a lot about AI, artificial intelligence, and all that stuff, but at the end of the day, some of the functionality of this innovation in fintech isn't that complicated.
I completely agree. There are different components and different fintech companies where you can get by with some standard kind of technology that's out there. I would say the technology behind what Milo is doing is actually fairly advanced. Our CTO is an AI guru here in the Montreal space, and what we're trying to do is build the technology to help these users make the right decisions and do so at a large scale. So definitely very complicated what we're building on our back end.
For the user, how much does this cost? And can you sort of provide that perspective in terms that investors know currently, which is if you go to a bank and you buy a mutual fund, you're paying an MER of somewhere around 2.3% or so.
Absolutely. So for most users, they don't understand the terms like MER, AUM, so management expense ratio or assets under management. So they don't know exactly how they're being charged or what they're being charged. This is what makes Milo very special. We are a flat fee, $1 a month. We don't charge any additional percentages of your assets under management. So you could invest $10 or $1 million and have it only cost you $12 a year. Far cheaper than you could actually execute trades on your own for, and one of the most easy to understand pricing models in the market. We invest in very low-cost ETFs, and those ETFs have a management expense ratio typically between 0.1 to 0.25.
And the user pays that? They pay the MER on the underlying ETF?
Absolutely. So they don't actually see or pay that fee directly. What happens when they invest their money, it would come out of that investment. But yeah, that'd be the $1 plus the MERs that the ETFs charge, and they'd be paying anyways if they were to buy those same ETFs.
How are you going to make any money?
Absolutely. So it's a business model that's predicated off of user success. So when we make these recommendations, when we are able to find a product that's aligned with the user's best interest and they're successful, we may get paid a referral fee on the back end for doing so.
Right.
But our algorithms are all agnostic. We've made sure to leave that out. It's the same way that when you work and you buy something off Amazon, they sell the Amazon products in line with everyone else, but you know at the end of the day that those algorithms are based off of your best interest and you're finding the best recommendations for you.
It's an important thing to note, because that is different than most of the robo-advisors out there where you pay what you pay and there isn't that affiliate model at play.
Absolutely. And the second part is obviously the dollar a month with the volume. It definitely helps. We've been able to create a very low-cost, essentially robo-advisor to be able to do so. And as we continue to grow at scale, that will definitely be a great revenue model for us.
Philip, thanks for your time today.
Absolutely. Thank you very much.
Appreciate it. Philip Brar is the CEO of Milo. Interesting roundup and affiliate model. Lots of stuff. Interesting to hear about that new model. Stay with us. Coming up later on the show, the Moolala questionnaire. But next, taxing treats, a new survey from Consumer Reports on so-called sin taxes. Hey, I'm the money columnist for a TV show called Cityline. You can check out segments that I do on cityline.ca. Search for me. We do all sorts of fun stuff. I even got slimed once. That was fun. We'll be right back.
Listening to Moolah La, Money Made Simple with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
Well, it isn't news that eating an overabundance of sugary sweets and junk food can be harmful to your health. But in the U.S., it might also hurt your wallet sometime soon. A new survey for Consumer Reports found that 42% of Americans think the government should be taxing unhealthy behavior. Tricia Calvo is the author of the report, the deputy content editor of Food and Health at Consumer Reports. She joins us now from Yonkers, New York. Hello there.
Hi, Bruce. Glad to be with you.
Did this number surprise you? In your view, is 42% a lot or a little who would be in favor of taxing unhealthy behavior?
It's a solid amount. I mean, it's a little bit higher than what I would think, because you often hear that people are resistant to taxes on things like sugary drinks or cigarettes or alcohol. But it is a sizable amount of people. And what's really interesting is that the majority of people in our survey who favored behavior taxes on sugar sweetened beverages.
Interesting. And I don't know, were you able to determine whether or not people felt that that would be helpful to them personally, or whether it was just a delightful judgment of the people who were carrying a few extra pounds? Or like, I don't know what's going on with her, but if you taxed Coke, she'd be thinner.
No, we just didn't. We didn't ask about that specifically, unfortunately.
Now, Canada has a sin tax on alcohol and tobacco. It differs regionally, but it certainly is something that we talk about. There's been a lot of debate recently about a donut tax here. Tell us more about the survey and what else you learned from the questions that you asked.
Well, you know, the United States has the distinction of being the most obese nation in the world. You know, and I think that I've read, too, that in Canada, the obesity rates are pretty high.
Yeah.
So, you know, there are all sorts of interventions about how are we going to conquer this problem? Because the healthcare costs that result from obesity are massive. I mean, there's increased risk of diabetes and heart disease and a number of different things. But also, it's for public health. So the sugar taxes on sugar-sweetened beverages, it seems to be like an easy way to perhaps help people cut the calories that they're eating. Because sugary beverages have about 16 teaspoons of added sugars. So and no nutritional value.
Yeah.
So it really is, you know, that's above what in public health officials in the United States think you should have in a day. So that's like 9 to 10 teaspoons is the max that you should have.
One of the other data points, your survey found that 73% of people said they'd eat more healthy food if it cost less. Why is healthier food so much more expensive?
Well, healthier food, you know, oftentimes you have to take into account, you know, people associate healthy and fresh, right? So fresh fruits and vegetables, there are labor costs, there are storage costs, you know, meat, there are spoilage, everything like that. And there is a scale of the unhealthier foods like chips and soda and things. And, you know, they're put by big corporations and they can often offer prices to scale.
Chickpeas, I was talking about chickpeas earlier on the show. They're cheap. They're healthy. Do you think it's just marketing? We need to sell the chickpeas more? We need to get the Hostess Frito-Lay people working on lentils and other pulses?
I think that we have to sort of take a multi-pronged approach. You know, one thing is to encourage people to eat healthier foods and to let them know that it doesn't mean deprivation. And that chickpeas are, you know, an incredibly healthy food and, you know, you can eat them, you know, in their whole form or they even make hummus, which is a great dip. And then instead of chips, you can serve it with fruits and vegetables. I mean, with vegetables, not fruits.
You could have just invented something right there. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know. Can you think like grapes? And
yeah, on apples. I love it. It's delicious.
Take apples and hummus. That's great.
Yeah.
So I think that there's that. I think there's the education piece. There's the encouraging piece. There's the making healthier foods more accessible to people and less expensive. And then also educating people about the real health risks of eating a heavy junk food diet.
How do you layer in the socioeconomic dynamic? And I say that because people at lower incomes may live in a food desert where literally there's just no healthy food to be found in the neighborhood that they live in. And there can be lower levels of education where people simply haven't been indoctrinated into the problems of having this kind of unhealthy food all the time. They also may work in these establishments. How do you weave that into what policies make the most sense?
I think that, you know, that's a real concern. And, you know, in the United States, we have what has been termed food deserts, where there are places where there aren't, like, big grocery stores where people can get a lot of fresh fruits and vegetables. They're limited to fast food joints or smaller convenience stores that tend not to carry the healthier foods and also are higher priced. So I think it's a real factor, and I think that it does come down to trying to help people fit more of those healthier foods into their diet and really speaking to them where they are at. So, you know, if this is what you have, how can you make the most of it?
Was there a regional dynamic in terms of your survey results? And the hypothesis that I would test is that in red states, ones that are right leaning, they would have an aversion to the addition of any tax, regardless of whether or not it's focused on improving health outcomes. Does that hypothesis play out, or do you know?
Well, our survey was a nationally representative survey, but we didn't break it down by region.
Do you think culturally that that syntaxes could work given what's going on politically in your country?
I think there's a lot going on about taxes, obviously, and I think that people's opinions on taxes and which taxes are a good idea differ. But I think that what we have to focus on a little bit more is that, it's not one intervention isn't going to solve the obesity problem. So it's a little piece of it. We have to focus on, more of a global approach. And, looking at cigarettes, for example, when the reduction in smoking rates occurred in the United States over the years, it really was a result of extra taxes on cigarettes, but also public education and bans on advertising and other educational efforts. So it really all compiled to reduce the smoking rate to about 15% when it was over 40% of
yeah.
American adults.
I don't know that there'd be a Super Bowl if you banned the advertising on sugary drinks, would there?
There's a lot of advertising, and I think that the advertising doesn't necessarily convey. It makes drinking soda look like an everyday thing and a lot of fun and that you should be downing it, but it's not really giving you the information about how you can fit these kinds of foods into your diet in
right.
moderation or whether you should be, consuming them at all.
Yeah. Well, Tricia, we appreciate your perspective. Thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
Tricia Calvo is Deputy Content Editor of Food and Health at Consumer Reports. She was here to talk about the sin taxes, in particular on sugary treats, and how many Americans think that could be the right path to take. Stay with us. Coming up next, getting paid to grocery shop with Instacart. We'll learn more about a new grocery service coming to Canada that could earn you some extra cash. And we'll take you through the Moolala questionnaire. You can sign up for our newsletter at moolala.ca and subscribe to the podcast version of this radio show on iTunes. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Moolala, Money Made Simple, with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
Life is expensive. Mortgage, kids, pets, bills, eating out, the odd vacation, maybe some clothes. Sometimes your 9-to-5 job just doesn't cut it. So what do you do? Maybe it's time to look at a bit of a side hustle. Instacart is a new grocery shopping service that pays you to grocery shop for others. Joining us now to talk about Instacart's launch here in Canada is Senior Regional Director Dave Osborne. Thanks for being here.
It's great to be here today.
What is Instacart? How does it work? Is it as simple as it's the Uber of groceries? You rolled your eyes a little bit when I said that. Why did you roll your eyes?
It's very similar to that. We don't necessarily like that comparison, but I think it's the easiest.
Is there another one that you prefer?
We think it's just an awesome way to get your groceries. Super easy for customers, and again, a great thing for people to do to have this side hustle to make a little extra money.
So you have launched in a whole bunch of markets in the U.S. Why Canada? Why was Canada next for you?
Well, we have great partnerships up here. Loblaws is our launch partner, and they were very excited to bring grocery delivery to Canada, and we really wanted to partner with them. And so now was the time to take that opportunity up here in Canada.
The existing way is you order your groceries online, it gets picked in a warehouse or in a store, gets boxed up and delivered to your house. That's been around for 15 years. How does this way work?
Sure. We're more on demand, so you can get your delivery in as little as 1 hour. And when a customer places an order via our website or via the app, it's dispatched to one of our shoppers who are out in near stores, and they'll go into your favorite store, like a Loblaws, and pick out the best of the best that's on the shelves at Loblaws and deliver it right to your door.
How much do they make? I mean, obviously, we're talking about personal finance, so our first objective is to think about this from a side hustle perspective. How does the comp work for them?
Sure. Their payments are based on each order. So they're paid on a by order basis. And here in Toronto, the average shopper is going to make anywhere between $16 to $18 an hour.
Do they deliver it as well? So they go to the store, pick it, bag it, and deliver it?
That's right. Yep, one person does the full order, soup to nuts.
How do you train them? I am very particular about bananas. Yeah. Very particular about bananas.
Yeah, well, we don't do training. Our contractors come to us with the skills to be great shoppers. And within the app, our shopping app that the shoppers use, makes it very easy to, again, pick the best of the best produce, the best meat, everything that you want in the store.
When you say skills, how do you screen for that?
Sure. Well, the anyone that wants to become a shopper can go online and they'll go through a tutorial that talks to them about what being a great shopper really looks like. And there's some Q&A in there to make sure they're getting the information.
How does being a great shopper differ? Because I would say I'm a great shopper, but how I shop is different from the person who would also call themselves a great shopper, because our needs are different. So when I stare at the shelf of chickpeas, I'm buying the 99 cent chickpeas. I'm not buying $1.29, buying the 99 cent chickpeas, but I'll pay more in other categories. How does that nuance play out for the shopper in store?
Sure. I think the important thing for a shopper is to be customer focused. And our app really allows customers to put in all kinds of detail and customization into their order. So let's say you're making guacamole tonight, so you want the ripest avocados. You can put that note in your order and say, make sure you pick the ripest avocados because I'm using these tonight.
And what happens if the local grocery store doesn't have a ripe avocado? What I would do if it was me is I'd go to four stores, find the avocado, and then come home. Does the Instacart shopper do that?
Well, the Instacart shopper is then going to contact the customer and say, hey, you know, this store doesn't have any ripe avocados. What would you like me to
do? They've got a sale on salsa.
Yeah.
Let's just change the menu a little bit.
You know, maybe they're going to get the prepared guacamole, which at Loblaws, I'm sure, is great. So that may be a great substitution, but they're going to contact the customer, make sure that works.
What is the profile of the ideal shopper? For whom does this make tons of sense?
I don't think there's a specific profile. We have a very diverse shopper base. Many students do it because they want a very flexible schedule. We have many actors and artists whose own schedules may be unpredictable. We certainly have parents who have responsibilities for their kids that could change with odd hours. And because it is a contract role, the shoppers choose when they work. And that flexibility is really valuable for a lot of different people.
Now, we know the peak hours for someone who's driving for Uber, it's not 2 p.m. You know, it's bar closing time. What is the peak hour for a Instacart shopper?
Yeah, there's certainly a rush in the morning. So there will be a bit of a morning rush between, call it 8 to 10 a.m. And then certainly in the afternoon and early evening, when a lot of people are getting home from work and those customers want those deliveries, call it between 5 and 7 p.m.
Do you think that's a competitive advantage versus Uber? Those are days or those are times when an Uber driver might not be as busy.
For sure. For sure. I mean, those times to work are going to be very attractive to many people, especially folks that may not want to work at 2 a.m.
One of the big supply management challenges that the online grocery retailers had to figure out was, how do I get the tomatoes to the customer without them getting crushed? It's one thing if you buy a tomato and crush it yourself. It's another thing entirely if someone delivers you a crushed tomato. How do you ensure that the quality of what ends up in the person's fridge meets their standards?
Yeah, the shoppers will be handling the groceries just like you would in the store. So they're going to go through checkout. They're going to bag all of those goods themselves and hand them off face-to-face to you at your doorway. And you can look through them right away. If you see any problems, you can talk to the shopper about that right away, or certainly reach out to Instacart if there are any issues.
So let's come at this from the consumer perspective. What is the delivery charge that they would pay, and how does that compare with, you know, one of the other online delivery options they could have?
Yeah, the delivery charge is going to vary based on the time you're ordering and the amount you're ordering, but the standard delivery fee is $3.99. Those are for orders that are $35 and greater.
So just true that up to me for you're paying the shopper more than that. So where's the difference?
Yep. And so then there's also a service fee that's a percentage of the order that the customer will pay. Customer has the option to tip the shopper as well. And then certainly for Instacart, in terms of our revenue, we have other net revenue sources like the retailers and CPG companies.
How does Instacart determine who they're going to work with? And can I send my shopper to any retailer in my neighborhood, or does it need to be one that you're affiliated with?
Yeah, only our partner retailers will be available in the app or on the website. So when you go on the website, you type in your postal code, and you'll see the retailers that are available to you.
In other markets that are more developed, do you have more retail partners, or is the idea that you develop a deep relationship with one in a particular geographic region?
In the U.S., many of our markets, we have multiple retailer options available. And certainly here in Canada, we will have multiple Loblaws-owned banners. So Loblaws, TNT, Real Canadian Superstore, those are the initial banners that will be available to consumers in Toronto.
What about non-grocery? Can you send an Instacart shopper to buy cannabis? And I don't know, what other scandalous things can I suggest?
Well, right now, I don't think we can do that in Canada.
Soon, it's coming.
If Loblaws were to one day have that available and would like to partner with us and we can meet whatever regulatory hurdles, that's certainly a maybe. But right now, we wouldn't do that. We don't do alcohol. We don't do cigarettes. There are certain items that we can't buy.
Interesting. Well, a really fascinating model, Dave. I appreciate you coming to talk about it.
All right. Thank you.
Dave Osborne is Instacart's Senior Regional Director. They're launching here in Canada. This could be a way for you to earn some bucks on the side. Time now for the Moolala Questionnaire. This is our series of questions modeled after the Proust Questionnaire in Vanity Fair magazine, one of my favorite magazines ever. Kevin Cochran is taking our questionnaire today. He's the co-founder of Enriched Academy, a digital educational program that teaches people how to take control of their money. You ready, Kevin? The first thing that comes to your mind.
Let's rock and roll.
How would you describe your money personality?
Based on experiences.
Oh, and what does that mean?
Concerts, you know, anything that that it leaves a memory.
So you love, and are you, would you say you're a saver or a spender?
Oh, I'm definitely a saver.
'Twas ever thus? Was it always that way?
No. The first 4 years out of high school, my credit got so bad that someone stole my identity. My credit rating got better.
That's good. You've used that line before. That's very good. And
yeah,
what was there a transformational moment? Did you get visited by the ghost of Chris's past, present, and future?
Funny enough, I had a good mentor. You know what? I'm a huge believer in mentors. I had a guy that came into my life, Richard Robbins, and taught me a lot about money, and he put me on a different path.
What's financial freedom mean to you?
Peace of mind.
What's one of your guiltiest spending pleasures? Not when you graduated from high school, but now, today.
Concerts.
Okay, name a band you haven't yet seen that you would spend $500 for a ticket to see.
You know what? Pink.
Pink. Okay. And would that even qualify as a guilty spending pleasure for you? Or given how focused you are on experiences, would that be, you know, just your cost of doing business?
Cost of doing business.
When do you plan to retire and what will you do other than see Pink? Maybe you'll become her biggest groupie and follow her around the world.
Hilarious. No, you know what? I never plan to retire. I love working, right? But definitely trying to create more of a work-life balance. That's my focus. So
you talked about your money mentor. What is one of the most powerful lessons he taught you?
Don't buy a new car.
Don't buy a new car. Did he slap you upside the head? How did he convince you that that was a terrible idea?
Well, you know what? There's not an investment in the world that I would ever go and put my money into and lose 30% right off the bat, and that's a car. So it was pretty logical when I heard that.
Right. He just explained it to you. Okay, so what do you drive now?
I have a 2010 Ford F-150 pickup.
That you bought when it was how old?
When I bought it in 2011.
Ah, so new to you in 2011. Tell me about your worst financial mistake. I mean, you talked about a couple of tough years there. Was there a single bad decision or a long, extensive series of small financial mistakes?
No, it's a bunch of, you know, small ones, but one that pops in my mind. I bought my first car on a credit card at 19% interest. I had no idea what I was doing. I just, again, just thought I did. I got 37% in high school math, so I said, you know what? And I cheated to get that. So I just figured, hey, that would be probably the highlight of my worst mistakes ever.
If you landed a huge financial windfall, I'm calling $25 million huge, what would you do with it?
What would I'd save and invest it. You know, I was fortunate enough last year to be in a company that had a huge cash event, and I was fortunate enough to get a fairly big check out of that.
So you've already got your $25 million. You don't even need it.
You know what? It was a good day, right? And I don't say that to impress, just impress upon. And, you know, I look at Warren Buffett. He lives in the same home that he bought in 1958 for $31,500. And you know what? If he didn't have to buy a bigger house, neither do I.
If you could snap your fingers and change one financial behavior in society at large, what would it be?
Buying things to change your state of mind.
Okay. Does that include like a whole buffet of sin options?
Absolutely. Yeah. You know what? I think a lot of people go out and buy things they can't afford to, you know, feel better because they don't like the job they're in or they're in a lot of debt and they're trying to ignore it and they go in more debt by buying more stuff.
We talk a lot about the head orientation towards personal finance, less about the heart orientation and or the emotional side of it. And for a lot of people, that really is the fundamental issue. What do you believe is the most effective way to help people work through the emotions that often affect their ability to behave responsibly when it comes to their money?
I think it's trying to find ways to, you know, feel great about, you know, doing things that don't cost a lot of money. Right. You know, again, even with my family, I am very cautious. The fact that, you know, that we're in a place where we have a little bit more money than we did in the past. But I still try to make sure with my three kids, because I got three young kids, that they appreciate the little things. And I don't mean to draw a long, drawn out answer, but this is important. Right. Because I have mentors. I look at people that have great kids that grew up with money. And how do they do it? And I'm a big guy, again, on experiences, and twice a year I'll put my kids to bed on a Saturday night, and then 15 minutes later I'll wake and run into the room and say, get your clothes on, we're going to McDonald's for ice cream, and, you know, play the music loud, and you think they just want a trip to Disney World, and you know, for $2.50 for, you know, an ice cream cone or whatever it costs, you know, they talk about it for the next 2-3 weeks, they're just so excited about it. So I think that's... If there's any message to anybody watching, I'm like, try to find, you know, the simplicity and the joy and just simple things like having sleepovers in your bedroom with the kids and, you know, like making camping and just stuff like that, right? So, yeah.
Merry Christmas. Here's some used Tupperware and a wooden spoon. Have fun. That's your present. Kevin, thanks for your time. We appreciate it.
I appreciate it. Thank you very much.
Kevin Crockman's co-founder of the Enriched Academy. That is our program for today. You can drop us a line to ask@moolala.ca. You can find me on Twitter at Bruce Selry or Bruce Selry Moolala on Facebook. I'm not on Instagram. I'm not on any of those things. But you can listen to past episodes of this radio show. You can go to iTunes. You can also go to moolala.ca. And on the website, you can listen to both the full show and also specific segments. Thanks very much for joining us. Have a great rest of your day.